Welcome to an introduction to Darwin's Black Box by Dr. Michael Behe, Associate Professor of Biochemistry at Lehigh University. Additional copies of this tape may be ordered from Access Research Network, area code 719-633-1772, or visit our website at worldwideweb.arn.org/arn for a full listing of our products. And now, Professor Behe.
The title of my book is Darwin's Black Box. Black box is a whimsical term for a device that does something, but whose inner workings are mysterious, either because they can't be seen or because they just aren't comprehensible. A good example of a black box is a computer. Most of us use these marvelous devices without the vaguest idea of how they work. We process words or plot graphs or play games in contented ignorance of what is going on behind the cover. Even if we remove the cover, though, no one but the cognoscenti can make heads or tails of the stuff inside. It's a jumble of pieces with no simple, observable connection between the parts of the computer and the things that it does. Now, it seems that the human mind, whenever it sees a black box in action, imagines that the contents of the box are simple. A happy example is found in the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes on the first Transparency. Calvin is always jumping in a box with his tiger Hobbes and traveling back in time, or using a box as a duplicator and making copies of himself. A little boy like Calvin easily imagines that a box can fly like an airplane or something, because Calvin doesn't know how airplanes work. In some ways, grown-up scientists are just as prone to wishful thinking as little boys like Calvin. Throughout history, the one constant expectation about biological black boxes was that once they were opened, they would turn out to be simple. The expectation has always been disappointed. A good illustration is the belief in spontaneous generation. Centuries ago, it was thought that insects could arise directly from spoiled food. This was easy to believe because before the invention of the microscope, biologists thought that insects had no internal organs and were very simple. But as biology progressed and careful experiments showed that protected food did not breed insects, the theory of spontaneous generation retreated to the limits of detectability. In the 19th century, that meant the cell. When beer or milk sat for several days in containers, even closed ones, they always became cloudy from something growing in them. The microscopes of the 18th and 19th centuries showed that the growth was very small, apparently living cells. So it seemed reasonable to conclude that simple living organisms could arise spontaneously from liquids. The key to persuading people was the portrayal of the cell as simple. One of the chief advocates of the theory of spontaneous generation was Ernst Haeckel, a great admirer of Darwin and an eager popularizer of Darwin's theory. From the limited view of cells that microscopes provided, Haeckel believed that a cell was a, quote, simple little lump of albuminous combination of carbon, close quote, not much different from a piece of microscopic jello. So it seemed to Haeckel that such simple life could easily be produced from inanimate matter. In 1859, the year of the publication of The Origin of Species, the HMS Cyclops dredged up some curious-looking mud from the sea bottom. Haeckel thought that the mud closely resembled some cells he had seen under a microscope. Excitedly, he showed the mud to Thomas Henry Huxley, next slide, Darwin's great friend and defender. Huxley also became convinced that it was Urschleim, that is, protoplasm, the progenitor of life itself, and Huxley named the mud Bathybius Haeckelii, after the eminent proponent of abiogenesis. The mud failed to grow. In later years, with the advance of science, the complexity of the cell was revealed. The simple lumps were shown to contain thousands of different types of organic molecules, proteins, and nucleic acids, many discrete subcellular structures, specialized compartments for specialized processes, and an extremely complicated architecture. Looking back from the perspective of our time, the episode of Bathybius Haeckelii seems silly or downright embarrassing, but it shouldn't. Haeckel and Huxley were behaving naturally, like Calvin. Since they were unaware of the complexity of the cell, they found it easy to believe that cells could originate from simple mud. Although scientists of the last century thought cells were simple, they knew that the eye was complex. In the 19th century, the anatomy of the eye was known in great detail, and its sophisticated features astounded everyone who was familiar with them. Scientists of the time correctly observed that if a person were so unfortunate as to be missing one of the eye's many integrated features, such as a lens or iris or ocular muscles, the inevitable result would be a severe loss of vision or outright blindness. So it was concluded that the eye could only function if it were nearly intact. Charles Darwin knew about the eye, too. In The Origin of Species, Darwin dealt with many objections to his theory of evolution by natural selection. He discussed the problem of the eye in a section of the book appropriately entitled Organs of Extreme Perfection and Complication. Somehow, for evolution to be believable, Darwin had to convince the public that complex organs could be formed gradually in a step-by-step process. He succeeded brilliantly. Cleverly, Darwin didn't try to discover a real pathway that evolution might have used to make the eye. Instead, he pointed to modern animals with different kinds of eyes, ranging from simple to complex, and suggested that the evolution of the human eye might have involved similar organs as intermediates. Next slide, please. Here is a paraphrase of Darwin's argument. Although humans have complex Cambra-type eyes, many animals get by with less. Some tiny creatures have just a simple group of pigmented cells, not much more than a light-sensitive spot. That simple arrangement can hardly be said to confer vision, but it can sense light and dark, and so it meets the creature's needs. The light-sensing organ of some starfishes is somewhat more sophisticated. Their eye is located in a depressed region. This allows the animal to sense which direction the light is coming from, since the curvature of the depression blocks off light from some directions. If the curvature becomes more pronounced, the directional sense of the eye improves. But more curvature lessens the amount of light that enters the eye, decreasing its sensitivity. The sensitivity can be increased by placement of gelatinous material in the cavity to act as a lens. Some modern animals have eyes with such crude lenses. Gradual improvements in the lens could then provide an image of increasing sharpness, as the requirements of the animal's environment dictated. Using reasoning like this, Darwin convinced many of his readers that an evolutionary pathway leads from the simplest light-sensitive spot to the sophisticated camera-type eye of man. But the question remains, how did vision begin? Darwin persuaded much of the world that a modern eye evolved gradually from a simpler structure, but he did not even try to explain where his starting point, the simple, light-sensitive spot, came from. On the contrary, Darwin dismissed the question of the eye's ultimate origin. Next, please. How a nerve comes to be sensitive to light hardly concerns us more than how life itself originated, he said. He had an excellent reason for declining the question. It was completely beyond 19th century science. How the eye works, that is, what happens when a photon of light first hits the retina, simply could not be answered at that time. As a matter of fact, no question about the underlying mechanisms of life could be answered. How did animal muscles cause movement? How did photosynthesis work? How was energy extracted from food? How did the body fight infection? No one knew. To Darwin, vision was a black box. But today, after the hard cumulative work of many biochemists, we are approaching answers to the question of sight. Next, please. Here's a brief overview of the biochemistry of vision. Hold on to your seats. When light first strikes the retina, a photon interacts with a molecule called 11-cis-retinal, which rearranges within picoseconds to transretinal. The change in the shape of retinal forces a change in the shape of the protein rhodopsin to which the retinal is tightly bound. The protein's metamorphosis alters its behavior, making it stick to another protein called transducin. Before bumping into activated rhodopsin, Transducin had tightly bound a small molecule called GDP. But when transducin interacts with activated rhodopsin, the GDP falls off and a molecule called GTP binds to transducin. GTP is closely related to, but critically different from, GDP. GTP transducin activated rhodopsin complex now binds to a protein called phosphodiesterase, located in the inner membrane of the cell. When attached to activated rhodopsin and its entourage, the phosphodiesterase acquires the ability to chemically cut a molecule called cGMP, a chemical relative of both GDP and GTP. Initially, there are a lot of cyclic or cGMP molecules in the cell, but the phosphodiesterase lowers its concentration, like a pulled plug lowers the water level in a bathtub. Another membrane protein that binds cGMP is called an ion channel. It acts as a gateway that regulates the number of sodium ions into the cell. Normally, the ion channel allows sodium ions to flow into the cell, while a separate protein actively pumps them out again. The dual action of the ion channel and pump keeps the level of sodium ions in the cell within a narrow range. When the amount of cGMP is reduced because of cleavage by the phosphodiesterase, the ion channel closes, causing the cellular concentration of positively charged sodium ions to be reduced. This causes an imbalance of charge across the cell membrane, which, finally, causes a current to be transmitted down the optic nerve to the brain. The result, when interpreted by the brain, is vision. I didn't do this. I read about it. My explanation is just a sketchy overview of the biochemistry of vision. Ultimately, though, this is what it means to explain vision. This is the level of explanation for which biological science must aim. In order to truly understand a function, one must understand in detail every relevant step in the process. The relevant steps in biological processes occur ultimately at the molecular level. So a satisfactory explanation of a biological phenomenon, such as vision or digestion or immunity, must include its molecular explanation. Now that the black box of vision has been opened, it is no longer enough for an evolutionary explanation of that power to consider only the anatomical structure of whole eyes, as Darwin did in the 19th century, and as popularizers of evolution continue to do today. Each of the anatomical steps and structures that Darwin thought were so simple actually involves staggeringly complicated biochemical processes that cannot be papered over with rhetoric. Darwin's simple steps are now revealed to be huge leaps between carefully tailored machines. Thus, biochemistry offers a Lilliputian challenge to Darwin. Now the black box of the cell has been opened and a Lilliputian world of staggering complexity stands revealed. It must be explained. How can we decide if Darwin's theory can account for the complexity of molecular life? It turns out that Darwin himself set the standard. He acknowledged that if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But what type of biological system could not be formed by, quote, numerous successive slight modifications, unquote? Well, for starters, a system that is irreducibly complex. Irreducible complexity is just a fancy phrase I use to mean a single system which is composed of several interacting parts and where the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to stop functioning. Next slide, please. Let's consider an everyday example of irreducible complexity, the humble mousetrap. The mousetraps that my family uses consist of a number of parts. There are, one, a flat wooden platform to act as a base, two, a metal hammer, which does the actual job of crushing the little mouse, three, a spring with extended ends to press against the platform and the hammer when the trap is charged, next, a sensitive catch, which releases when slight pressure is applied, and last, a metal bar, which connects to the catch and holds the hammer back when the trap is charged. Now, you can't catch a few mice with just a platform. Add a spring and catch a few more mice. Add a holding bar and catch a few more. All the pieces of the mousetrap have to be in place before you catch any mice. Therefore, the mousetrap is irreducibly complex. An irreducibly complex system cannot be produced directly by numerous successive slight modifications of a precursor system, because any precursor to an irreducibly complex system that is missing a part is by definition non-functional. An irreducibly complex biological system, if there is such a thing, would be a powerful challenge to Darwinian evolution. Since natural selection can only choose systems that are already working, then if a biological system cannot be produced gradually, it would have to arise as an integrated unit in one fell swoop for natural selection to have anything to act on. Demonstration that a system is irreducibly complex is not a proof that there is absolutely no gradual route to its production. Although an irreducibly complex system can't be produced directly, one can't definitively rule out the possibility of an indirect circuitous route. However, as the complexity of an interacting system increases, the likelihood of such an indirect route drops precipitously. And as the number of unexplained, irreducibly complex biological systems increases, our confidence that Darwin's criterion of failure has been met skyrockets toward the maximum that science allows. In a few minutes, we'll talk about some biochemical systems and ask if they are irreducibly complex. But first, I have to give you a little background material. In order to understand how the cell works, you have to know a little bit about proteins. Most people think of proteins as something you eat. In the body of a living animal or plant, however, they play very active roles. Proteins are the machinery of living tissue that builds the structures and carries out the chemical reactions necessary for life. For example, the first step in capturing the energy in sugar and changing it into a form that the body can use is carried out by a catalyzing protein, also known as an enzyme, called hexokinase. Skin is made up mostly of a protein called collagen. When light strikes your retina, the protein called rhodopsin initiates vision. You can see by this limited number of examples that proteins are amazingly versatile. Nonetheless, a given protein has only one or a few uses. Rhodopsin cannot form skin, and collagen cannot interact usefully with light. Therefore, a typical cell contains thousands and thousands of different kinds of proteins to perform the many tasks of life. Proteins are made by chemically hooking together amino acids into a chain. A protein chain typically has anywhere from about 50 to about 1,000 amino acid links. Each position in the chain is occupied by one of 20 different amino acids. In this, they are like words. Words can come in various lengths, but they are made up from a set of just 26 letters. As a matter of fact, biochemists often refer to each amino acid by a single letter abbreviation, G for glycine, S for serine, H for histidine, and so forth. Each different kind of amino acid has a different shape and different chemical properties. For example, W is large, but A is small. R carries a positive charge, but E carries a negative charge. S prefers to be dissolved in water, but I prefers oil, and so forth. When you think of a chain, you probably think of something that's very floppy, without much overall shape. But chains of amino acids, proteins, aren't like that. Proteins that work in a cell fold up into very precise structures, and the structure can be quite different for different types of proteins. The folding is done automatically when, say, a positively charged amino acid attracts a negatively charged one. Oil-preferring amino acids huddle together to exclude water. Large amino acids are pushed out of small spaces, and so forth. Two different amino acid sequences, two different proteins, can fold into structures as specific and different from each other as a 3/8-inch wrench and a jigsaw. It is the shape of a folded protein and the precise positioning of different kinds of amino acid groups that allow a protein to work. For example, if it is the job of one protein to bind specifically to a second protein, then their two shapes must fit each other like a hand in a glove. If it is the job of a protein to catalyze a chemical reaction, then the shape of the enzyme generally matches the shape of the chemical that is its target. When it binds, the enzyme has amino acids precisely positioned to cause a chemical reaction. If the shape of a wrench or a jigsaw is significantly warped, then the tool doesn't work. Likewise, if the shape of a protein is warped, then it fails to do its job. Now, let's go back to irreducible complexity. Are any biochemical systems irreducibly complex? Yes, it turns out that many are. A good example is the cilium. Next slide, please. Cilia are hair-like structures on the surfaces of many animal and lower plant cells, and they can move fluid over the cell's surface or row single cells through a fluid. Seen on the top, in humans, cells lining the respiratory tract each have about 200 cilia that beat in synchrony to sweep mucus toward the throat for elimination. What is the structure of a cilium? The cilium is shown in cross-section on the lower part of the slide. A cilium consists of a bundle of fibers called an axoneme. An axoneme contains a ring of 9 double microtubules surrounding 2 central single microtubules. Each outer doublet consists of a ring of 13 filaments, subfiber A, fused to an assembly of 10 filaments, subfiber B. The filaments of the microtubules are composed of 2 proteins called alpha and beta tubulin. The 11 microtubules forming an axoneme are held together by 3 types of connectors. Subfibers A are joined to the central microtubules by radial spokes. Adjacent outer doublets are joined by linkers of a highly elastic protein called nexin, and the central microtubules are joined by a connecting bridge. Finally, every subfiber A bears 2 arms, an inner arm and an outer arm, both containing a protein called dynein. Next slide, please. Let's look at the bottom of the next slide. How does a cilium work? Experiments have shown that ciliary motion results from the chemically powered walking of the dynein arms on one microtubule up a second microtubule, so that the 2 microtubules slide past each other. The protein crosslinks between microtubules in a cilium prevent neighboring microtubules from sliding past each other by more than a short distance. So they try to go like this, but they get stuck by the nexin. These crosslinks, therefore, convert the dynein-induced sliding motion to a bending motion of the entire axoneme. Now, let us consider what this implies. What components are needed for a cilium to work? Ciliary motion certainly requires microtubules, otherwise there would be no strands to slide. Additionally, we require a motor, or else the microtubules of the cilium would lie stiff and motionless. Furthermore, we require linkers to tug on neighboring strands, converting the sliding motion into a bending motion and preventing the structure from falling apart. All of these parts are required to perform one function, ciliary motion. Just as a mousetrap does not work unless all of its parts are present, ciliary motion simply does not exist in the absence of microtubules, connectors, and motors. Therefore, we can conclude that the cilium is irreducibly complex, an enormous monkey wrench thrown into its presumed gradual Darwinian evolution. Now let's talk about a different biochemical system, blood clotting. Amusingly, the way in which the blood clotting system works is reminiscent of a Rube Goldberg machine. The name of Rube Goldberg, the great cartoonist who entertained America with his silly machines, lives on in our culture, but the man himself has pretty much faded from view. Here's a typical example of his humor. In this cartoon, Goldberg imagined a system where where water from a drain pipe fills a flask, causing a cork with attached needle to rise and puncture a paper cup containing beer, which sprinkles on a bird. The intoxicated bird falls onto a spring, bounces up to a platform, and pulls a string, thinking it's a worm. The string triggers a cannon, which frightens a dog. The dog flips over, and his rapid breathing raises and lowers a scratcher over a mosquito bite, causing no embarrassment while talking to a lady. When you think about it for a moment, you realize that the Rube Goldberg machine is irreducibly complex. It is a single system which is composed of several interacting parts and where the removal of any of them causes the system to break down. If the dog is missing, the machine doesn't work. If the needle hasn't been put on the cork, the whole system is useless. It turns out that we all have Rube Goldberg in our blood. Here's a picture of a cell trapped in a clot. The meshwork is formed from a protein called fibrin. But what controls blood clotting? Why does blood clot when you cut yourself, but not at other times when a clot would cause a stroke or a heart attack? Here's a diagram of what's called the blood clotting cascade. Hold on again. Let's go through just some of the reactions of the clotting. When an animal is cut, a protein called Hegemann factor, we're going to work from the top left to the bottom right, you may be able to see it. A protein called Hegemann factor sticks to the surface of cells near the wound. Bound Hegemann factor is then cleaved by a protein called HMK to yield activated Hegemann factor. Immediately, the activated Hegemann factor converts another protein called prekallikrein to its active form, kallikrein. Kallikrein helps HMK speed up the conversion of more Hegemann factor to its active form. Activated Hegemann factor and HMK then together transform another protein called PTA to its active form. Activated PTA, in turn, together with the activated form of another protein called convertin, switch a protein called Christmas factor to its active form. Activated Christmas factor, together with antihemophilic factor, which is itself activated by thrombin in a manner similar to that of proaccelerin, changes Stuart factor to its active form. Stuart factor, working with accelerin, converts prothrombin to thrombin. Finally, thrombin cuts fibrinogen to give fibrin, which aggregates with other fibrin molecules to form the meshwork clot you saw in the last picture. When a pressurized blood circulation system is punctured, a clot must form quickly or the animal will bleed to death. On the other hand, if blood congeals at the wrong time or place, then the clot may block circulation, as it does in heart attacks and strokes. Furthermore, a clot has to stop bleeding all along the length of the cut, sealing it completely. Yet blood clotting must be confined to the cut, or the entire blood system of the animal might solidify, killing it. Consequently, clotting requires this enormously complex system so that the clot forms only when and only where it is required. Blood clotting is the ultimate Rube Goldberg machine. My final example of irreducible complexity is a system that targets proteins for delivery to subcellular compartments. The cell contains a number of subcellular compartments to perform specialized tasks. These include things called lysosomes for digestion, Golgi vesicles for export, and others. Unfortunately, the machinery for making proteins is outside these compartments. So how do proteins which perform tasks in subcellular compartments find their way to their destination? It turns out that proteins that will wind up in subcellular compartments contain a special amino acid sequence near the beginning called a signal sequence. As the proteins are being synthesized, a complex molecular assemblage called the signal recognition particle, or SRP, binds to the signal sequence. This causes synthesis of the protein to halt temporarily. During the pause in protein synthesis, the SRP binds the membrane SRP receptor, which causes protein synthesis to resume, and which allows passage of the protein into the interior of a space called the endoplasmic reticulum. As the protein passes into the ER, the signal sequence is cut off. Next slide, please. For many proteins, the ER is just a way station on their travels to their final destinations. This is a little cartoon of what happens next. Proteins which will end up in a lysosome are enzymatically tagged with a carbohydrate residue called mannose-6-phosphate while still in the ER. That's the little shape being put on the black ball, which is the protein. An area of the ER membrane then begins to concentrate several proteins. One protein, called clathrin, forms a sort of geodesic dome called a coated vesicle, which buds off from the endoplasmic reticulum, the ER. In the dome, there is also a receptor protein, which binds to both the clathrin and to the mannose-6-phosphate group of the protein which is being transported. The coated vesicle then leaves the ER, travels through the cytoplasm, and binds to the lysosome through another specific receptor protein. Finally, in a maneuver involving several more proteins, the vesicle fuses with the lysosome, and the protein is at its destination. During its travels, our protein interacted with dozens of macromolecules to achieve one purpose, its arrival in the lysosome. Virtually all of the components of the transport system are necessary for the system to operate, and therefore the system is irreducible. The consequences of even a single gap in the transport chain can be seen in the hereditary defect known as Icell disease. It results from a deficiency of the enzyme that places the mannose-6-phosphate on proteins to be targeted to the lysosomes. So that oval in the first panel is missing. Icell disease is characterized by progressive retardation, skeletal deformities, and early death. Other examples of irreducible complexity abound in the cell, including aspects of electron transport, the bacterial flagellum, telomeres, photosynthesis, transcription regulation, and much more. Examples of irreducible complexity can be found on virtually every page of a biochemistry textbook. But if these things cannot be explained by Darwinian evolution, how has the scientific community regarded these phenomena in the past 40 years? Next slide, please. A good place to look for an answer to that question is in the Journal of Molecular Evolution. JME is a journal that was begun specifically to deal with the topic of how evolution occurs on the molecular level. It has high scientific standards and is edited by prominent figures in the field. In a recent issue of JME, there were published 14 articles. Of these, all 14 were concerned simply with the comparison of protein or DNA sequences. Now, a sequence comparison is an amino acid by amino acid comparison of two different proteins, or a nucleotide by nucleotide comparison of two different pieces of DNA, noting the positions at which they are identical or similar and the places where they aren't. Although useful for determining possible degrees of relationship, which is an interesting question in its own right, comparing sequences cannot show how a complex biochemical system achieved its function, the question that most concerns us here. By way of analogy, the instruction manuals for two different models of computer put out by the same company might have many identical words, sentences, and even paragraphs suggesting a common ancestry. Perhaps the same author wrote both manuals. But comparing the sequences of letters in the instruction manuals will never tell us if a computer can be produced step by step, starting from a typewriter. None of the papers discussed detailed models for intermediates in the development of complex biomolecular structures. In the past 10 years, JME has published over 1,000 papers. Of these, about 100 discussed chemical synthesis of molecules thought to be necessary for the origin of life. About 50 proposed mathematical models to improve sequence analyses, and about 800 were analyses of sequences. There were zero papers discussing detailed models for intermediates in the development of complex biomolecular structures. This is not a peculiarity of JME. No papers are to be found that discuss detailed models for intermediates in the proceedings of the National Academy of Science, Nature, Science, the Journal of Molecular Biology, or, to my knowledge, any science journal whatsoever. Many scientists are skeptical that Darwinian mechanisms can explain all of life. However, a large number do believe it. Since the professional biochemical literature contains no papers or books that explain in detail how complex systems might have arisen, why is Darwinism nonetheless credible with many biochemists? A large part of the answer is that they have been taught, as part of their biochemical training, that Darwinism is true. To understand both the success of Darwinism as orthodoxy and its failure as science at the molecular level, let's briefly examine the textbooks that are used to teach aspiring scientists. Some textbooks make a concerted effort to enculturate students into an evolutionary view of the world. For example, a textbook by Vogt and Vogt contains a marvelous full-color drawing nicely capturing the orthodox position. The top third of the drawing shows a volcano, lightning, an ocean, and little rays of sunlight to suggest how life started. The middle of the picture has a stylized drawing of a DNA molecule leading out from the origin of life ocean and into a bacterial cell to show how life developed. The bottom third of the picture, no kidding, is like the Garden of Eden, depicting a number of animals that have been produced by evolution milling about. Included in the throng are a man and a woman, the woman offering the man an apple, both especially attractive and in the buff. This undoubtedly adds to the interest for students, but the drawing is a tease. The implicit promise that the secrets of evolution will be uncovered is never consummated. Students are taught how to view the world, but no explanations for complex biochemical systems are given in the textbook. A good place to find out the real importance of Darwinian evolution to the understanding of biochemistry is in the textbook's index. An index lists all the subjects covered in the book, and the number of citations is a rough measure of the subject's importance. A survey of 30 biochemistry textbooks used in major universities over the past generation shows that many textbooks ignore evolution completely. For example, Thomas Devlin of Jefferson University wrote a biochemistry textbook that has gone through 3 editions. The first edition has about 2,500 entries in its index. The second also has 2,500, and the third about 5,000. Of these, the number referring to evolution are 0, 0, and 0, respectively. A textbook by Frank Armstrong of North Carolina State University, published by Oxford University Press, is the only recent book to include an historical chapter reviewing important developments in biochemistry, beginning with the synthesis of urea by Friedrich Wöhler in 1828. The chapter does not mention Darwin or evolution. In 3 editions, Armstrong's book has found it unnecessary to mention evolution in its index. Another textbook, published by John Wiley and Sons, has 1 citation to evolution in its index out of a total of about 2,500. It refers to a sentence on page 4, quote, "Organisms have evolved and adapted to changing conditions on a geological timescale and continue to do so." Nothing else is said. Many students learn from their textbooks how to view the world through an evolutionary lens. However, they do not learn how Darwinian evolution might have produced any of the remarkably intricate biochemical systems that those texts describe. Surprisingly, the idea of molecular evolution is not based on science. There is no publication in the scientific literature, in journals or books, that describes how molecular evolution of any real complex biochemical system either did occur or even might have occurred. There are plenty of assertions that such evolution occurred, but absolutely none are supported by pertinent experiments or calculations. Since there is no authority on which to base claims of knowledge, it can truly be said that the assertion of Darwinian molecular evolution is merely bluster. "Publish or perish" is a proverb that academicians take seriously. If you do not publish your work for the rest of the community to evaluate, then you have no business in academia. And if you don't already have tenure, you will be banished. But the saying can be applied to theories as well. If a theory claims to be able to explain something, but does not generate even an attempt at an explanation, then it should be banished. Despite comparing sequences, molecular evolution has never addressed the question of how complex structures came to be. In effect, the theory of Darwinian molecular evolution has not published. So what's going on? Imagine a room in which a body lies crushed, flat as a pancake. A dozen detectives crawl around, examining the floor with magnifying glasses for any clue to the identity of the perpetrator. In the middle of the room, next to the body, stands a large gray elephant. The detectives carefully avoid bumping into the pachyderm's legs as they crawl, and never even glance at it. Over time, the detectives get frustrated with their lack of progress, but resolutely press on, looking even more closely at the floor. You see, textbooks say detectives must get their man, so they never consider elephants. There is an elephant in the room full of scientists who are trying to explain the development of life. The elephant is labeled intelligent design. to a person who does not feel obliged to restrict his search to unintelligent causes, the straightforward conclusion is that many biochemical systems were designed. They were designed not by the laws of nature, not by chance and necessity. Rather, they were planned. The designer knew what the systems would look like when they were completed. The designer took steps to bring the systems about. Life on Earth, at its most fundamental level, in its most critical components, is the product of intelligent activity. The conclusion of intelligent design flows naturally from the data itself, not from sacred books or sectarian beliefs. Inferring that biochemical systems were designed by an intelligent agent is a humdrum process that requires no new principles of logic or science. It comes simply from the hard work that biochemistry has done over the past 40 years, combined with consideration of the way in which we reach conclusions of design every day. What is design? Design is simply the purposeful arrangement of parts. The scientific question is how we detect design. This can be done in various ways, but design can most easily be inferred for mechanical objects. While walking through a junkyard, you might observe separated bolts and screws and bits of plastic and glass, most scattered, some piled on top of each other, some wedged together. Suppose you saw a pile that seemed particularly compact, and when you picked up a bar sticking out of the pile, the whole pile came along with it. When you pushed on the bar, it slid smoothly to one side of the pile and pulled an attached chain along with it. The chain in turn yanked a gear, which turned three other gears, which turned a red and white striped rod, spinning it like a barber pole. You quickly conclude that the pile was not a chance accumulation of junk, but was designed because you see that the components of the system interact with great specificity to do something. Next. It is not only artificial mechanical systems for which design can easily be concluded. Systems made entirely from natural components can also evince design. Anybody looking at this, at the cartoon, can immediately conclude that this was not an actual accidental collection of parts, that the parts were put together intentionally and designed as a trap. It would not matter if these folks were walking in Africa or if they were explorers that had just landed on an alien planet and were walking along. They would conclude that the trap had been designed. Now, let's talk a bit about some common objections to the theory of intelligent design. Over the centuries, most people have believed that life was designed. However, in recent years, a number of arguments have been advanced against it. Let's consider several of the most important arguments. The first is the argument of Darwin, that complex systems can be produced gradually. However, since the science journals contain no example of this, defenders of evolution have had to base their arguments on an analogy. In his book, Philosophy of Biology, the philosopher Elliot Sober illustrates with an analogy borrowed from Richard Dawkins. Could you just put that on and just show the top third of the drawing? I'm quoting now from Elliot Sober, and this is going to be an extended quotation. Imagine a device that is something like a combination lock. It is composed of a series of disks placed side by side. On the edge of each disk, the 26 letters of the alphabet appear. The disks can be spun separately so that different sequences of letters may appear in the viewing window. There are 26 to the 19th power different possible sequences. One of these is, methinks it is a weasel. The probability that methinks it is a weasel will appear after all the disks are spun is 1 in 26 to the 19th power, which is a very small number indeed, still quoting Elliot Sober. But now imagine that a disk is frozen if it happens to put a letter in the viewing window that matches the one in the target message. The remaining disks that do not match the target then are spun at random, and the process is repeated. What is the chance now that the disks will display the message, methinks it is a weasel, after, say, 50 repetitions? The answer is that the message can be expected to appear after a surprisingly small number of generations of the process. Variation is generated at random, but selection among variants is non-random. Close quote by Sober. This is a professional philosopher. What is wrong with the sober analogy? Everything. It purports to be an analogy for natural selection, which requires a function to select. But what function is there in a lock combination that is wrong? Next, the middle portion, please. Suppose that after spinning the disks for a while, we had half of the letters right, something like you see on the slide. Every other letter is correct. He thinks it is a weasel. The analogy asserts that this is an improvement over a random string of letters and that it would somehow help us open the combination lock. But if your life depended on opening a lock that had the combination, me thinks it is a weasel, and you tried mid-to-e-fig-ken-rexel, you would be pushing up daisies. If your reproductive success depended on opening the lock, you would leave no offspring. Next, lower part, please. Evolution, we are told by proponents of the theory, is not directed toward a goal. But then, if we start from a random string of letters, why do we end up with me thinks it is a weasel instead of my darling Clementine, or me be Tarzan, you be Jane? As a disc turns, who is deciding which letters to freeze and why? Instead of an analogy for natural selection acting on random mutation, the sober scenario is actually an example of the very opposite, an intelligent agent directing the construction of an irreducibly complex system. The agent, sober here, has the target phrase, lock combination, in his mind and guides the result in that direction as surely as a fortune teller guides a Ouija board. This hardly seems like a secure foundation upon which to build a philosophy of biology. Another argument advanced against design is the argument from imperfection. It can be briefly stated. If there exists an intelligent agent who designed life on Earth, then he would have been capable of making life that contained no apparent flaws. Furthermore, he would have done so. The argument seems to have a measure of popular appeal. However, it boils down to saying that because something does not fit our idea of the way things ought to be, then that is evidence against design. An example of the argument from imperfection is seen in an article by Ken Miller, professor of biology at Brown University, and incidentally a fellow Catholic. In Technology Review, he argues that things called pseudogenes are inconsistent with the theory of intelligent design. Pseudogenes are pieces of DNA that resemble real genes, but do not produce proteins in the cell. He says, the theory of intelligent design cannot explain the presence of non-functional pseudogenes unless it is willing to allow that the designer made serious errors, wasting millions of bases of DNA on a blueprint full of junk and scribbles. There are several ways to answer this objection, but I will only state one. The objection arises from the confusion of two separate ideas, the theory that life was intelligently designed and the theory that the Earth is young. Because religious groups who strongly advocate both ideas have been in the headlines over the past several decades, much of the public thinks that the two ideas are necessarily linked. Implicit in Ken Miller's argument about pseudogenes and absolutely required for his conclusions is the idea that the designer had to have made life recently. That is not a part of intelligent design theory. The conclusion that some features of life were designed can be made in the absence of knowledge about when the designing took place. An art museum might display a statue of a bronze cat that was supposed to have been made in Egypt thousands of years ago, until the statue was examined by technologically advanced methods and shown to be a modern forgery. But in either case, real or forgery, old or new, the bronze cat was certainly designed by an intelligent agent. The irreducibly complex biochemical systems that we have discussed here did not have to be produced recently. It is entirely possible, based simply on an examination of the systems themselves, that they were designed billions of years ago, and that by the normal processes of cellular reproduction, they have been passed down to the present. Perhaps a speculative scenario will illustrate the point. Suppose that nearly 4 billion years ago, the designer made the first cell already containing all irreducibly complex biochemical systems. And then the cell containing the design systems was left on autopilot to reproduce, mutate, eat and be eaten, bump against rocks, and suffer all the vagaries of life on Earth. During that process, pseudogenes might occasionally arise, or a complex organ might become non-functional. These chance events do not mean that the initial biochemical systems were not designed. The warts and wrinkles of life that some take as evidence of evolution may simply be evidence of age. When it is considered by itself, away from logically unrelated ideas, the theory of intelligent design is seen to be quite robust, easily answering the argument from imperfection. However, intelligent design theory has to be seen in context. It does not try to explain everything. We live in a complex world where lots of different things can happen. When deciding how various rocks came to be shaped the way they are, a geologist might consider a whole range of factors: rain, wind, glaciers, moss and lichens, the action of volcanoes, nuclear explosions, asteroid impacts, or the hand of a sculptor. The shape of one rock might have been determined primarily by one mechanism, the shape of another rock by another mechanism. The possibility of a meteor's impact does not mean that volcanoes can be ignored. The existence of sculptors does not mean that many rocks are not shaped by weather. Similarly, evolutionary biologists have recognized that a number of factors might have affected the development of life: common descent, natural selection, migration, population size, founder effects, genetic drift, gene flow, linkage, meiotic drive, transposition. The fact that some biochemical systems were designed by an intelligent agent does not mean that any of the other factors are not operative, common, or important. After seeing the stunning complexity of the cell, you might ask, why is science reluctant to embrace a theory of intelligent design? There are several reasons. Time precludes me from discussing them all. However, one of the most powerful reasons is based on philosophical considerations. Many people, including many important and well-respected scientists, think that design indicates a designer who is beyond nature, and they just don't want there to be anything beyond nature. For example, to many people, the notion of the Big Bang is loaded with overtones of a supernatural event, the creation, the beginning of the universe. When the theory was first proposed, the prominent physicist A.S. Eddington spoke for many in voicing his utter disgust with such an idea. He said, "Philosophically, the notion of an abrupt beginning to the present order of nature is repugnant to me, as I think it must be to most. And even those who would welcome a proof of the intervention of a creator will probably consider that a single winding up at some remote epoch is not really the kind of relation between God and his world that brings satisfaction to the mind." Nonetheless, despite its religious implications, the Big Bang was a scientific theory that flowed naturally from observational data, not from sacred writings or transcendental visions. So most physicists adopted the Big Bang theory and set their research programs accordingly. But it should also be noted that the Big Bang, although friendly to a religious point of view, does not forcibly compel that belief. No person is required by dint of logic to reach any particular supernatural conclusion based solely on the on scientific observations and theories. So, to explain the universe, some people have postulated unobservables, like the theory that there are infinitely many universes, or the theory that ours is just a bubble in a larger universe. Or one can hold out the hope that theories that look implausible today, such as the steady state theory or the theory of an oscillating universe, might look more plausible tomorrow when calculations are redone or new measurements are taken. Or, for those who want, they can simply abandon the principle of causation, as is seen in theories that propose that the universe came into being uncaused. Here is that even though the Big Bang hypothesis may appear at first blush to support a particular religious idea, no scientific theory can compel belief in a positive religious tenet by sheer force of logic. Saying that the universe began in a Big Bang is one thing, but saying life was designed by an intelligence is another. The phrase Big Bang itself evokes only images of an explosion, not necessarily a person. The phrase intelligent design seems more urgent and quickly invites questions about who the designer might have been. Will persons with philosophical commitments against the supernatural be painted into a corner by the theory? No. The human imagination is too powerful. For example, consider Francis Crick. By any measure, Sir Francis H.C. Crick is a smart man. Over 40 years ago, while still a graduate student at Cambridge University, Crick and James Watson deduced the double helical structure of DNA, an accomplishment for which they later received the Nobel Prize. Francis Crick also thinks that life on Earth may have begun when aliens from another planet sent a rocket ship containing spores to seed the Earth. This is no idle thought. Crick first proposed it with chemist Leslie Orgel over 20 years ago in an article entitled Directed Panspermia in a professional science journal called Icarus. A decade later, Crick wrote a book called Life Itself, reiterating the theory. And recently, in an interview in Scientific American on the eve of the publication of his latest book, Crick reaffirmed that he thinks their theory is reasonable. Crick's scenario still leaves open the question of who designed the designer. How did life originally originate? Is a philosophical naturalist now trapped? Again, no. The question of the design of the designer can be put off in several ways. It could be deflected by invoking unobserved entities. Perhaps the original life is totally like ourselves, consisting of fluctuating electrical fields or gases. Perhaps the other life does not require irreducibly complex structures to sustain it. Another possibility is time travel. The possibility of time travel has been seriously proposed by professional physicists in recent years. Perhaps then, biochemists in the future will send back cells to the early Earth that contain the information for the irreducibly complex structures we observe today. In this scenario, humans can be their own aliens, their own advanced civilization. If Francis Crick or someone else said that they think the designer of life was a space alien or a time traveler, I wouldn't be able to contradict them based on the biochemical evidence. Most people, like me, will find those scenarios entirely unsatisfactory, but for people who wish to avoid theological implications, they are available. How will science officially treat the question of the identity of the designer? Will biochemistry textbooks have to be written with explicit statements that God did it? No. The question of the identity of the designer will simply be ignored by science. The history of science is replete with examples of basic but difficult questions being put on the back burner. When a question is too difficult for science to deal with immediately, it is happily forgotten while other more accessible questions are investigated. If, in the meantime, philosophy and theology want to take a crack at the question, we scientists should wish them well, but reserve the right to jump back into the conversation when science has something more to add. So, as this talk concludes, we are left with what many people feel to be a strange conclusion, that life was designed by an intelligent agent. In a way, though, all of the progress of science over the last several hundred years has been a steady march toward the strange. People up until the Middle Ages lived in a natural world. The stable Earth was at the center of things. The sun, moon, and stars circled endlessly to give light by night and day. The same plants and animals had been known since antiquity. Surprises were few. Then it was proposed, absurdly, that the Earth itself moved, spinning while it circled the sun. No one could feel the Earth spinning. No one could see it. But spin it did. From our modern vantage, it's hard to realize what an assault on the senses was perpetrated by Copernicus and Galileo. They said, in effect, that people could no longer rely on even the evidence of their eyes. Things got steadily worse over the years. With the discovery of fossils, it became apparent that the familiar animals of field and forest had not always been on Earth. The world had once been inhabited by huge alien creatures who were now gone. Sometime later, Darwin shook the world by arguing that the familiar biota was derived from the bizarre, vanished life over lengths of time incomprehensible to human minds. Einstein told us that space is curved and time is relative. Modern physics says that solid objects are mostly space, that subatomic particles have no definite position, that the universe had a beginning. Now it's the turn of the fundamental science of life, modern biochemistry, to disturb. The simplicity that was once expected to be the foundation of life has proven to be a phantom. Instead, systems of horrendous, irreducible complexity inhabit the cell. The resulting realization that life was designed by an intelligence is a shock to us in the 20th century, who have gotten used to thinking of life as the result of simple natural laws. But other centuries have had their shocks, and there is no reason to suppose that we should escape them. Humanity has endured as the center of the heavens moved from the earth to beyond the sun, as the history of life expanded to encompass long-dead reptiles, as the eternal universe proved mortal. We will endure the opening of Darwin's Black Box. Thank you.
Additional copies of this tape may be ordered from Access Research Network, area code 719-633-1772, or visit our website at worldwideweb.arn.org/ARN for a full listing of our products.